Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I'm Carlos Galazzo, joined as always by Peter Flaherty. And we also have a special addition to the show this week, Jeff Ponce, joining us to talk some draft. So this will be a fun episode. Hello, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Excited to talk through our second staff draft.
And Jeff, thank you for joining us, man.
Hey, man. Happy to be on.
Yeah, so if you guys are not aware, on the site today, as you're listening to this podcast, you can see our second version of the staff draft that we do, where we basically five BA writers, all three of us on the show today, in addition to Ben Badler and JJ Cooper, just play scouting director and try and work down the board. We went through the entire first round as well as the first supplemental round, so through picks 39. JJ is the loser in this scenario. He gets cut a pick short after picking fifth. But I figured today we could kind of just walk through this staff draft, talk about our thought processes with players, talk about our thoughts on the draft class as it's shaping up mid-May. It's the last week of regular season college baseball. It feels like it's flown by. But I'm really excited just to get some insight into how you guys were thinking about the board, how you guys were thinking about your picks, and just how that differs from maybe how I think or how listeners might think about the class. So if you guys have any thoughts before we get into it, please, by all means, jump in. Peter, you have anything?
No, nothing. I'm excited to break it all down.
All right, then. Okay, Jeff, unless you have any just top of the show comments you want to make on the draft class, I guess we can get right into it. But I'll let you have the chance if you have anything to mention.
Yeah, I think the most interesting thing is we've seen this sort of onslaught of power production, you know, especially in the Power Five conferences, I think just really stands out even in comparison to a couple years ago. And it's funny, this week as I was, you know, writing up the hot sheet on the minor league side, I was sort of reminded of Nico Cavadas and just how much power he had. And it pales in comparison to what we've seen from Cagliannone and what we've seen from Condon this year. And then I had another discussion with someone who's with a team and another discussion with someone who's actually with a Power Five college. And just talking about how each of them are sort of trying to translate the exit velocity data and some of the numbers seen with these metal bats. Because what the standard is for like a 60, we'll say max exit velocity or 90th percentile exit velocity with wood at the professional level is like a 50 or a 45 when we look at the college exits right now. So it's just, it's so funny how out of whack it is. So I think that's, it's just like another sort of like rabbit hole that everyone kind of can dive into. But I also think it's like a pitfall for potential teams to maybe buy some fool's gold too, depending upon what it is. Not saying that's the case with Condon or with Cagliannone, but I think it's interesting.
Yeah, well, I certainly hope it is not a pitfall with Charlie Condon, because I had the first pick. I basically was debating between Charlie Condon and then Peter and Jeff's favorite player, Travis Bezzana, for 1-1. Ultimately, I went with Condon just for a little bit more upside potential and power potential. I don't think either one would have been wrong, but I took Condon 1. Ben took Travis Bezzana 2, and it seemed like it was whoever I didn't take 1, he was going to take 2. And then, Peter, you had pick number 3. Explain your process there, and then you guys can judge me for Charlie Condon if you would have gone another direction if you want.
it kind of feels like at this point, as we whittle it down a little bit more, you have this tier of like eight to 10 or so guys. And then within that tier, it feels like Conan and Bazzana have separated themselves as one and two, however you want to slice that up. So I knew that they would be off the board at this point. And so it's almost like I was picking 1-1 in the tier break. And I was down to Braden Montgomery and Hagan Smith. It wasn't an easy choice at all. I flip-flopped a little bit before settling on Montgomery, but it's a really enticing and loud tool set, a hard one to turn down. You have the ever-improving hit tool, thunderous bat speed, and plus raw power from both sides of the plate. I especially like the whole product and operation itself from the left side. And then there's an argument to be made he's got the best arm of any position player in this year's class. I think that he does have the best arm of any position player in this class. Really good athlete, will be an impact defender in right field, and I believe in the bat and the improvements that it's made. So I ended up settling on Montgomery.
Yeah, and then it's fascinating. We have Montgomery 3 and then Jeff, who you took at 4. You had kind of another maybe inflection point of this draft class, because for me, I don't know who I prefer of the top two pitchers on the board, but you did take a pitcher with number 4, kind of making a statement on who you think is the best. And Peter, the fact that you mentioned Hagan Smith, it seems like you prefer him as well. So Jeff, I'll throw it to you and talk me through your pick, who you took and how you kind of separate those two arms.
Yeah, I think it's hard to separate the two arms. And I think that some of the potential positives and negatives of each of these pitchers are kind of, where with Burns, you know, it's just dominant stuff, right-handed pitcher, great fastball. You know, I had one evaluator that I talked to when I was watching Burns against BC describe the slider as a left turn at 90 miles an hour. And I thought that was a good descriptor, because that's kind of what it is. And then you have Hagan Smith, where, you know, it's sort of two dominant pitches again. There's probably more just health stuff that's maybe a concern. I think where he gets the edge for me is just how unique the fastball shape is for a left-hander with that power. And we've seen how left-handed stuff plays up, especially left-handed velocity. Like, you don't have to have the best fastball shape in the world. And some of your maybe sort of like average to slightly above average secondaries can really play up off of that fastball in pro ball. And I also, I mean, they both come from good development backgrounds, whether it's Arkansas or Wake Forest. If you probably had to pick two of the best pitching development schools in the country, I think both of those would come up in the top five discussion. I don't think that's saying anything that's too hot. It's a pretty cold take. So I think it really is a pick 'em. I'm going to go with the lefty hard. And I know it's just like, you know, kind of smooth brained with that one, like throw hard left-handed. But I really think that at the end of the day, that's the difference. And if we look back and both of these guys turned into, you know, mid rotation starters with more upside, you know, I think we could look back and say, hey, maybe these guys should have been 1-2 in this draft.
Yeah.
And especially when we're talking about guys up top that don't play in up the middle position. I don't think any teams will do that, but I do think they're right within that discussion of like the top tier at the top of this draft, which is obviously the, you know, overwhelming strength.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think I kind of agree. Like, I tend to view them pretty similarly. And then for me, I like the left-handed component that Hagan Smith brings, and I also just like his delivery a little bit more. But Peter, you also mentioned that it was between Braden Montgomery and Hagan Smith. So was there anything that Jeff didn't mention there that maybe sways you more towards Hagan Smith in this Burns-Smith debate? Because I know there are a lot of teams and scouts who would prefer Burns. It wouldn't be shocking to see him go first. So it's just kind of funny that maybe all three of us here prefer the lefty and Hagan Smith.
I echo everything that you guys said with Smith and Burns. I'd probably prefer Smith by hair, but like Jeff said, it wouldn't shock me at all, and I kind of project both to end up as like impact middle of the rotation type arms, potentially frontline starters. And with Smith, you have the two borderline double plus pitches from the left side with a budding split change. He looks the part of a legit workhorse this year. I think he put on 10 to 15 pounds of muscle in the off season. And like you guys said, I give him just the slightest of edges given that he's left-handed. But with Burns, similarly, you have these two double plus pitches and the thunderous fastball and hellacious slider, dump in a power curve and the low to mid 80s and turnover changeup every now and again. So it's a really tough debate and one I kind of flip-flop on almost week to week. But right now I'm leaning Smith.
Yeah. Okay. So then we had JJ making his first pick of this staff draft. He goes with Jack Caglione at number 5 for the White Sox, which left me deciding between Chase Burns, JJ Weatherholt, and Nick Kurtz. I was pretty surprised Burns was available here. I think I just didn't realize the degree to which you two liked Hagen Smith. And I was worried it was going to come down to Jack Caglione being the top player available on the board for me, because that profile is just one that I tend to want to be a little lower on. So I'm kind of glad that JJ took a bit of the risk to pursue some of the upside with Caglione. I was pretty thrilled with Burns. I think if Brayden Montgomery and Burns were both available, it'd be very tough for me to decide who I wanted. Like, if I went with Montgomery, it'd basically just be avoiding some of the just general pitcher risk you have with those guys breaking. But I really do feel like Burns could be a top 3 player in this class in the actual draft. And so I was pretty thrilled to get him here. I didn't think too much about Weatherholt and Kurtz, although maybe I should have thought about both of those a bit more, because I think they certainly fit in this range. I love Kurtz's offensive profile, but the first base and track record of first baseman this high kind of scares me. And then with Weatherholt, just the lingering hamstring injuries were enough for me to take a shot on a guy who has front of the rotation upside. So if any of you guys want to comment on that, feel free to. But after that, we had Ben popping up JJ Weatherholt. I think he was basically deciding between Weatherholt and Kurtz. He went with the left-handed hitting shortstop, and then that left Peter. I don't know if this was a tough decision for you at number 8, but you went with Nick Kurtz at number 8.
Yeah, it kind of was. I was really hoping that, one, Weatherholt would be there, and then, two, when I saw him go off the board, I was hoping at my next pick at 13 that Carson Benj would be there, because I didn't want to reach for him this high at 7. I think he's a really good player with an intriguing tool set, but 8 would be a little bit rich for me for Benj. So I went with Kurtz. I was close to taking Bryce Rayner. I was typing in Bryce Rayner, and then at the last second I pivoted to Kurtz. It was a slow start to the year for him, but he's been swinging it well for the last month and a half, fueled in large part by that torrid stretch in early April, where I think it was, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but I think it was 15 home runs in 12 games or 13 home runs in 10 games, something really, really gaudy. He's got a solid feel for the barrel as well. Overall chase rate, less than 20%. It's a really enticing and impressive hit power combination, as well as a track record. And you've also got a nimble plus defender over at first base. He handles himself really well. I'm a little worried about the health track record with Kurtz. And then also, like you said, that type of profile this early at 8, it certainly comes with some risk. So in hindsight, I probably should have /would have gone with Rayner. Could I do it all over again? But Kurtz certainly has the upside, especially with the bat, to be an impact member of the lineup.
Yeah. And then Jeff picking 9 for the Pirates. He went with right-handed pitcher Trey Savage out of ECU. Jeff, thoughts on that pick and just kind of how the board has evolved to you at this spot? Were there any other players you were debating? I would imagine taking this pitcher was maybe a little bit more obvious than your first pitcher, just given the gap in talent to whoever is next. But
yeah,
I'll turn it over to you.
Sure. So I really think there's a top 9 in this draft. I guess it depends on how you feel about the two prep players that are going in the next couple of picks here. But for me, I think, as I saw Yesevich available after, Kurtz and Weatherholt went, and I kind of imagined that I was going to end up with one of those 3 guys, and I thought the most likely one was going to be Savage. So I was happy to grab him. I just think from, a typical starter sort of build, mold, profile, I really think he has it in spades. He's got the build. He's 6'4", 225. We've seen how the command has played out over the course of the season, over 12 starts now. He's got, a 10-1 record, 1.6 ERA, if you're into that sort of thing, 0.84 whip. It's a 2.5 walk per 9 with a 14.9 K per 9. The stuff is good. It's a little bit behind Hagen Smith on our college stuff scale. It's a 111. Smith's 113. Chase Burns is all the way up there at 120. But I think the thing about that too, if we really dig into it, is the pitch mix is, you know, far more robust in terms of he mixes a bunch of different shapes. He throws a changeup a lot, which is going to hurt the overall stuff number kind of when we're looking at it from a traditional standpoint. But it's a good pitch. You know, he kills lift on it. It doesn't get a ton of arm side run, but it's got a little bit of fade. But it's a really good fastball. Slider, I think, is projectable. It's a gyro slider that I think he adds a couple ticks onto that, and it's more like 87 to 89 in pro ball versus the 85 to 87 that it is now. I think that's a potential plus pitch. And for my money, he's not that far behind Chase Burns in terms of the fastball quality. I know some of these devices in terms of operation are a little off, but he's averaging around or above 20 inches of induced vertical break on on the regular, sitting 94 to 95, touching 97, 98. So I think he's just a really interesting player. And I think in some shades of like Rhett Lauder last year, this is a guy, they're very different pitch, but a guy that's going to follow the back end of the top 10 that you're going to like, hey, this guy's going to move really quick and, you know, could potentially be a in rotation starter for you in 2 to 3 seasons. And I don't think that's saying anything out of turn.
Yeah, no, I agree entirely. Just his conviction and confidence in his secondaries and the ability to use those pitches at a high clip and command them and mix in with the profile makes for a really appealing pitcher. And the fact that he does have the command and control track record that he does, I think, is a separator for him and a lot of the other pitchers. So at number 10, JJ went with Bryce Rainer for the Nationals. I scooped up Connor Griffin at number 11 for the Tigers. Jeff, you had mentioned these two preps that were going to come off the board shortly after you took your Savage. That's the exact two players who did come off the board. In my spot, I was basically just going to take whichever one of these two high school players that JJ didn't take. And if he, for some reason, reached on another player and both are available, I probably would have leaned towards Connor Griffin anyways, even though for someone like me who just is obsessed with high school shortstops, maybe that's not the most intuitive pick for me. But I do feel like you're probably in a good spot picking 11 right now. I kind of view all the top 11 players who have gone off the board in this staff draft as like a top tier of sorts. After this, I really feel like the draft opens up in a big way, and I have difficulty separating players. I'm curious if you guys view it similarly, or if you feel like there are a few other players that you kind of like. But for me, there's like maybe 10 to 15 players that I think I can make cases for. And if you just look at the BA ranks of the players who are going off the board from 12 to 25, I think that backs it up. It either backs that up or the fact that our rankings need to be updated. But after me, Ben took Carson Benj at number 12 for the Red Sox. So it sounds like he's scooping you twice, Peter. And then you picked number 13 for the Giants and you went with Caleb Lomavita.
Yeah, I was bummed to see Benj go. I was so ready to jump on him. If Ben didn't take him, it turns out he did. And then I was, man, like I had three. This draft went a little differently for me than it did in staff draft 1.0. Basically all my guys were there. There weren't a ton of tough choices, but this one was anything but like, yeah, 13 was another tough one. Like in hindsight, now looking back on it, I kind of wish that I went with James Tibbs, but I was happy getting Lomavita, who I still view as the best catcher in the class. I know he's struggled recently. And I really, really like Walker Yannick too. He's my catcher number two, but I went with Lomavita. It's borderline. I think it's plus power to the pull side. The hit tool is taking a step forward. Like spin and breaking balls in general continue to be a bugaboo, which I'd like to see him improve upon. But he's an ultra athletic catcher. He defends really well, moves well behind the dish, got an above average arm. And then it's kind of a cherry on top of the profile. He's turning on routine above average run times. And I think he's a 10 to 15 plus stolen base type of guy when all is said and done, and the makeup is elite with him. So I went with Lomavita. I wish I had gone with Tibbs. I'm a little bit more convicted on Tibbs. Like if I was in a draft room, like I'd probably in this 13, 14, 15 range, I'd be pounding the table a lot more for Tibbs than I would Lomavita. So I should have gone with Tibbs, but I was happy to get Lomavita.
Buyer's remorse here at only pick 13. And Jeff,
it gets better for me.
I guess you're the beneficiary of this. Was Tibbs the guy you were targeting here at 14 for the Cubs, because you scooped him up with this pick. How were you thinking about this pick? Were there any other players you were considering? And I guess how difficult was it for you here?
Yeah, this was by far where it got the most difficult. And I think I sort of sat on it for a minute and went a few different directions. Tibbs, I felt like, was the safest play here. And I'll explain why in a minute. But the other names that I thought were in the mix were Christian Moore, Vance Honeycutt. You know, I end up taking him a little bit later, but Stallwell was in the mix. Brody Brecht, if you wanted to get really risky. But I think this is where, you know, this is very much like choose your own story. Like once we hit this point in the real draft, it's going to be really interesting to see where teams go, how they allot that bonus pool, you know, who ends up getting signed and who doesn't. It's tough. So yeah, I think at the end of the day, I went with Tibbs simply because, yeah, he's not the most athletic guy. It's going to be a corner outfield profile. Maybe he ends up at first base, but he can hit. And I know there's a question about that. There's bat to ball skills. It's at least above average if it's not close to plus. The swing decisions grade out really, really highly. The underlying, you know, exit velocity data is good. You know, it's a 107.6 90th percentile exit velocity. I think a pro ball, it's probably going to be 104.5, 105, which is fine. But he consistently elevates in this best contact too. I think that's something you see. Like his hard hit launch angle, 18.5 degrees. He's simply like on his best hit balls, he's consistently elevating. 65.2% ball and line drive percentage. So it shows out in the results as well. So I just felt like, you know, you're looking at a safe college bat here that can hit for power. Maybe not all that, maybe a step down from the Kurtzes and, you know, those guys that are going in the top 10. But I still think a valuable guy and someone's going to be, you know, at least an average regular at the professional level.
This might be a hot take by me. I don't know how far off he is from Kurtz.
Yeah, I think that's
I don't reasonable. Think it's that big of a gap.
Yeah, I mean, this is the reason that James Tibbs has been just flying up the board. It's a weak draft class. I think if you talk about this profile in the middle of the first round in 2023, there are a lot of other players that you can probably feel as excited or nearly as excited about the hit tool on top of having better athletic profiles and better defensive positions up the middle. Guys like Tommy Troy and Matt Shaw are the guys who were on the board here a year ago. I think like just the fact that you might get middle infielders there is exciting. That's not the case this year. And so when you have to decide, like Jeff, you're saying, it's pick your poison. What's your philosophy? At the end of the day, offensive tools are the most important thing for your position players. And if James Tibbs is the one player on the board here, after you get out of that elite tier where you feel great about the hit and the power, I think a lot of teams are just going to take the bat and figure out the position later.
And with Tibbs too, like Nick Kurtz hasn't had a summer at all since arriving with Wake where he's played with Wood. And I'm not saying it would look a whole lot different. Like I think everything would play well, like on the Cape, but he doesn't have USA. He doesn't have any Cape experience, none of that. I saw Tibbs do it all summer on the Cape with Brewster, the power plays with Wood. He'll drive the ball to all fields with backspin. Saw the baseball really well out of the pitcher's hand. Like the approach was there. I don't know. I think that it's a lot closer a gap than people realize or think.
All right. After Tibbs was off the board, JJ picking at 15 for the Mariners goes with his teammate at FSU, Cam Smith. I was on the board next for the Marlins at 16. I went with Walker Yannick, probably one of my more safer plays of this staff draft after shooting for big upside with Connor Griffin. I didn't really have a favorite in this next tier of players. There are a lot of players I'm intrigued with, but I also have concerns with. I don't think you're buying a lot of offensive upside here with Walker Yannick, but I think you are getting a pretty high probability big leaguer. And the fact that I think he is the best defensive catcher in this class and does a lot of things well that I think are going to be even more valuable at the big league level, just with his ability to control the run game. And even though I don't think you're buying like a plus hit tool or plus power, he has done well offensively. He's having a career best offensive season this year. I think he'll be fine. Offensively, for me, this is just a case of middle of the first round, bad draft class. I feel good about a big leaguer at catcher, so I'm just not going to overthink it too much and let some other people take maybe some of these profiles that do have more upside, but I have concerns about like hit tools or defensive profiles or strikes. So that was kind of my rationale. After that, Ben takes Christian Moore at 17 for the Brewers. I know he's a name that, came up kind of in this range for both of you. And then Peter, you at 18 are back on the board, and you go with Vance Honeycutt, the UNC tool shed and center fielder.
Yeah, so given how the board had kind of played out to this point, luckily Ben didn't pickpocket me for the, like, what feels like the ninth time in this half draft. But, yeah, and looking at who had gotten selected and then also who was, I guess, still left on the board, including Honeycutt, I went for the upside play here. And to be honest, no one in this range really has me overly excited, which, again, is part of the reason why I went for the high ceiling play. It's an equally low floor. But the miss and chase rates have kind of reverted back to 2022 for Honeycutt, but he's on pace for a career year at the plate. From an average standpoint, it'll be his first year where he hits above 300, which I know you can only make so much of batting average, but I think the fact that he's able to do it this year was a step in the right direction. And he's striking out a little bit of less of a clip than he did in that 2022 season where he went off. It's an elite level athlete, high impact plus defender in center field. He can really go and get it. Plus runner, lightning quick hands of the plate with plus power, I think. And it's just, like you said, it's an absolute tool shed. So with him at 18, I feel like that's a range in which you can feel pretty happy about getting someone with this type of upside and ceiling. So I was happy to jump on him.
All right, and then going right over to Jeff at pick number 19 for the Mets, you go with Slade Caldwell, who is maybe one of the most well-rounded high school profiles in this class. And you've been a guy who's pretty high on Caldwell, I feel like, for a while now. You always tend to come away with him in these staff drafts.
Yeah, I think the price is right, number one, just like where he slots in with this. I feel like there's plenty of upside. Yeah, like the physical size isn't what you necessarily want, but I think we've seen guys like this. We've seen guys like this go to the Mets, and it plays. It plays at the next level. You know, Drew Gilbert's one. It's the back end of our top 100. Smaller guy, has similar makeup, just in terms of like that gamer guy who plays with his hair on fire, shows up in big moments. I mean, thing with Caldwell is he hit consistently throughout. You know, the showcase events throughout his career. Somebody that I think, despite not being huge, like he's kind of a muscle hamster build. Like he's a stocky, strong guy, shows the ability to elevate. I think there might, you know, I think there's more than average power there potentially. Play up the middle, can run. Like I think overall, this is a really good baseball player, and you're getting somebody who's going to show up every day. Like you're not going to have to worry about this guy being motivated in the middle of July in Beloit, Wisconsin or whatever. Right. Like, so yeah, this is somebody where I probably end up with him a lot in a lot of staff drafts. And I feel like we talked about it after the top 10, that doesn't really feel like there's any like true consensus. So I think this guy's a first round talent. And I like the idea of like the short kings of Queens with him, Jet Williams and Drew Gilbert. And I know that Francisco Alvarez was thrown in there by Matt Eddy, who's now the tallest guy. So.
All right, love that one. Slade Caldwell is just a fun player to watch. He's a gamer, like you said. Every time I saw him over the showcase circuit, he was getting on base, impacting the game defensively with his legs. He's just a fun player to watch.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At 20, JJ's back up. He goes with Brody Brecht, right-handed pitcher at Iowa. JJ notes that he has improved in his strike throwing, has some of the best pure arm talent in the class. Very volatile pick, I'm sure. Polarizing player with a wide range of outcomes, but someone's going to take a chance on him. JJ does here at number 20. Coming back to me at 21 for the Twins. I saw Jeff is taking guys like Slade Caldwell. Some of these high school position players who are maybe not consensus ranked in this range are going to start going off the board. So I had to get a guy who I've increasingly found myself liking, and that's Theo Gillen, Texas shortstop, Texas high school shortstop. Again, my like preferred demographic. He might be one of the best pure hitters in the state of Texas. That's pretty high praise. And again, this is a draft class that I don't think has a lot of capital at no doubt shortstop profiles. I don't think Gillen is really a no doubt shortstop in the long run. I'm more buying this for the hit power combination, the physicality that he brings. It wouldn't shock me if he played second base or the outfield in the future, but I really just like the bat here. And there are not a lot of other bats that I love in this range. I considered Seaver King at this spot and assumed if I didn't take him here, I would miss out on him. Stay tuned if you want to see where he actually goes. But that was kind of my thinking. Gillen, Seaver King, slightly considered Billy Amick at Tennessee as well, but went with Gillen. Ben right behind me at 22 goes with Bryce Cunningham at Vanderbilt. And then Peter is on the clock now for 23 for the Dodgers.
Yeah, I'm happy you didn't snag Amick because that was the guy I kind of had circled for this range. And if he's there at 23 or beyond on draft night, even a little bit before 23, as you hinted at 21, I think you can be really happy about taking him. Bat first guy, narrowing it down a little bit, more power first guy, but I'm a real believer in it, and it translates with Wood. It was, again, not to keep talking about the Cape and Wood bats, but I saw him a couple of games on the Cape, went off. It's easily plus with Wood as well. Physical kid, built like a football player, and I mean that in a complimentary way. In the midst of an all-SEC type of season for Tennessee, hitting 347, career-high 18 home runs, and it's not a byproduct of, like, hot bats, the baseballs being, like, hitting golf balls. Like, it's real. It's comfortably plus power to all fields, backspins the ball really, really well, and he doesn't sell it at all to generate high-quality impact. His max EV this year, I think, is a little bit over 113. I mentioned super physical, big league-type body at 6'1", 220. You see him get off the bus, you're like, okay, he looks a little bit different than everyone else here. Big time bat speed, serious wrist and forearm strength. And a move to first base isn't out of the question for him defensively. Maybe it's a little more likely than it is not. I've been pleasantly surprised with his acumen over at third base this year. He's handled himself better than I thought. So questions maybe about the pure hit tool long-term, especially when it comes to picking up and hitting spin. But man, the power is real and the impact is super, super real. So was happy that he was still on the board here.
Yeah. And then right after you made this pick, I feel like Jeff took a player with some similar strengths, some similar question marks. One of the more dynamic players in this draft class. And I like that the fact that the spread of this player who you took, Jeff, and Vance Honeycutt is just 7 picks, because I think there are some interesting parallels to draw between those two players, and they feel like they have been getting closer and closer together on draft boards, and the outcome of this staff draft at least had them in a similar range. So talk me through your Dakota Jordan pick here for the Braves.
Yeah, talk about risky. It's like the opposite of the James Tibbs pick, but I think there's a ton of upside here. He's one of the best athletes in this class, draft eligible sophomore, you know, has had the baseball card production in the SEC, 17 pumps this year. He's hitting 370, 488, an 08 slug. So, I mean, overall, the numbers have been great. You dig under the hood a little bit. I mean, just even surface level, the strikeout rate is almost 30%, 28.7%, which is insanely high, even in the SEC. Walks, you know, so he is your true outcome hitter. But when you start to look at some of the underlying metrics, the end zone contact isn't bad. The contact rate overall, though, is well below average. It's a 30 grade contact rate, especially in college baseball. Chases a little bit too. It's not crazy, but 27% chase rate isn't necessarily what you want to see from a guy like that. Now, that being said, he barrels up a lot. puts the ball in the air pretty consistently, hits the ball hard more often than not. I think he's a 65% hard hit. So that kind of perspective, big EVs. I think he's a really exciting pick here for the Braves. Like, they could have time to kind of let him marinate for a couple of years. Yeah, I think Jordan has a lot of upside, but at the same time, there's definitely some warts in the profile too. I don't think that's saying anything out of turn.
Yeah, you're really not going to get any player on the board here in this range, and even 10 picks in front of us, where you have a really comprehensive, complete profile that you don't feel there are questions about in some capacity. JJ with the next pick, 25 for the Padres, takes a very Padres-esque pick in William Schmidt, high school right-handed pitcher out of Louisiana. JJ has had a number of high-risk, high-reward players in this class, even going with his first pick, Jack Caglione. He took Brody Brecht. He took one of the riskier just demographics in the draft with a high school righty. But the Padres have certainly been willing to take that profile. I think that makes sense on what they have tended to do in the past, and just value for William Schmidt here at 25. That left me with Seaver King available at 26 for the Yankees. I mentioned earlier I debated him at 21. I think it's just too far to let a guy like him fall. Like a lot of the players we talk about in this range, there are some questions. He's aggressive with his swing decisions. He does have impressive bat speed, impressive power for a guy of his size. I think it's a really good just athlete overall. He's a 70 runner pretty consistently. I've talked to some scouts who think he's going to stick at shortstop. I've talked to some other people who think he's maybe going to have to move off that position. I think wherever he winds up defensively, it's got a chance of being up the middle or at least a valuable position, whether that's third base, second base. I think he's going to play somewhere where you want a player to play. It's not going to be like a James Tibbs sort of defensive profile, although there's significantly less conviction in the pure hit tool getting to plus with King compared to a guy like Tibbs. So it's a pretty high upside pick. I think he has acquitted himself nicely in the ACC with Wake Forest. He has actually turned it on a little bit over the last month or so. Early on, it was pretty aggressive at times. But I think at 26 here, the overall athlete tool set, defensive profile is pretty good value. And the player that I'm most excited about on the board available now. So he was the pick for me fairly easily at this point. Then at number 27 for the Phillies, Ben takes PJ Morlando. This one is a bit high for me. I don't want to speak for Ben entirely, but Ben has long been a PJ Morlando fan. I know he will say that in terms of hit power combinations, he's one of the better ones in the high school class. And that left you at 28, Peter, picking for the Astros. You took high school right-handed pitcher Braylon Doty.
Yeah, I was super fired up that Doty was still on the board here. I actually don't think he's going to be on the board here at draft night based on absolutely nothing but my gut feel. But high school right-hander, durable physical kid, low maintenance delivery, repeats it really, really well. True four-pitch mix. Like, he'll hold 92, 94 and bump a five for the entirety of his outing. It has some life in the top of the zone. He's got a hammer slider, high spin pitch with a ton of bite to it, and also mix in a distinct curveball that'll flash some depth. He'll turn over a budding changeup that I think could be a solid, serviceable fourth offering. I think there's a lot to like with Doty. Not a whole lot of reliever risk for me. I think he could be a really solid three-starter one day. I was very, very happy he was there at 28.
Yeah, a little mini run of high school pitchers here in the late 20s. That left Jeff with his final true first-round pick at 29 for the D-backs. And Jeff, you maybe have the most fascinating pick and fascinating player of this entire staff draft for me. That's Kentucky outfielder Ryan Waldschmidt, who we currently have ranked 151, but that feels quite a bit light at this stage.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the feedback that I got after the most recent rankings, and just it's come up in conversations, not about the rankings, but just about the first round. It seems like Waldschmidt has played his way into the first round since he's returned from injury. The numbers are really good in SEC with a really good Kentucky team as well. 354, 488, 609. You know, there aren't any strikeout issues here. 14.9% strikeout rate to a 14% walk rate. And the underlying data in some ways is better than Tibbs, frankly. Higher end zone contact rate, contact rate's about the same. Lower chase rate, lower swing rate, but hits the ball harder. His upper echelon exit velocities are harder than Tibbs are. Hits the ball in the air. He's got a 60% fly ball, line drive rate. And then on top of it, in terms of the athletic testing, he is by far one of the best athletes of the college hitters that we've seen drafted already. So, you know, I don't know if there's teams that prefer him to Tibbs. I think it's reasonable to think that there could be teams that prefer Waldschmidt to Tibbs just simply because of what the upside is and what the potential output is just physically that I don't think Tibbs can match.
This pick and this player profile reminds me a little bit of last year when Colton Ledbetter was really moving up the board. And I think, Jeff, I even remember last year for you, you were one of the first people on him as he was ascending. You took him on the board despite the rankings at the time of the draft maybe not aligning with this pick. So you're on these guys early. You like these athletes with the underlying offensive performance. And when I was making doing a piece earlier this week on like a case for Travis Bezzana's 1-1 profile, one of the things that stands out about Bezzana is how well-rounded his underlying batted ball data is. One of the players who jumped out in a small bucket of players who really ranked top 40 in all five of these statistics that I was looking at, and this is top 40 of every college hitter we have data on ranked on our top 400, so it's not all players in D1 baseball, but kind of selected for the prospects we have ranked currently. So this is top 40 with average exit velocity, 90th percentile, peak EV, contact rate, and chase rate. So three that are looking at basically power and impact and then contact and chase. It was just Nick Kurtz, Travis Bezzana, Bucknell third baseman Sean Keyes, and then Ryan Waldschmidt, who were all ranked just really well in each of those categories. So it's a very well-rounded hitter. The numbers just surface level, 352, 488, 605, with nine homers, 14 doubles, has been impressive in Kentucky. So I like this pick, and it also just reinforces the fact that we have to constantly be updating our draft rankings to keep up with these guys. Because at the moment, this looks like an off-the-board pick by Jeff, but I think he really illustrates why it might not actually be. We should pay attention to Ryan Waldschmidt moving forward. After that, JJ took Kalen Culpepper, shortstop at Kansas State, at 30. I stuck with the shortstop profile and took high school shortstop Kellen Lindsey out of Florida. I just really love the tool set. I love the upside. He has been one of the bigger up arrow players in the country this spring, kind of along the same lines as Theo Gillen at my pick at 21. Maybe less conviction and offensive impact and less of a track record with this hit tool, but he does have bat to ball skills. He's an 80 grade runner. His shortstop actions have improved significantly this spring to the point where a lot of people are just putting above average pretty confidently for him to stick at that position. I feel like it's pretty good value for the upside potential he provides here at 31. After that, Ben at 32 for the Orioles takes Cam Caminiti, left-handed pitcher out of Arizona. Maybe a little surprising that he lasted this long. Ben certainly thought so in his rationale that he wrote for the class, but really exciting athlete, power fastball, some questions about his feel to spin the baseball, but certainly at 32 for one of the youngest players in the class, I think that's a good pick. And that left you up at 33 for the Twins, Peter.
Yeah, so I went with Jared Thomas, another one, I guess, comparatively speaking, a little bit off the board. He ranks currently 57th, and I snagged him at 33, but I really like him a lot, having a career year for Texas. He's a draft-eligible sophomore, slashing 359, 440, 650 with matching a career high with 15 doubles, career high 14. Like, he set career highs in basically every offensive category. 6'2", 195. He's noticeably more physical than he was last year. Looks a lot stronger in the box. It's serious hand speed, like a very explosive operation in the box. The miss and chase are up a little bit from last year, but it's also come with a drastic increase at that in production. And he's grown into some more impact. Like, he's hitting the ball harder, consistently driving the baseball a lot more. It's been really encouraging to watch how his offensive profile has progressed just year to year. And I think that the hit tool is definitely solid average. I'm not as bullish on the pure hit tool as I was maybe last year. But if you get him on a good day, I don't think a 55 is super unreasonable on it. But the one thing with him is, one, he's also a plus runner, a really good athlete, and the defensive profile adds to his upside and my conviction on him. He's played some first base this year for Texas. He's actually split his time, I guess, between first base and the outfield, 37 games at first compared to just 20 in center field, but I think he's going to make the shift full time to center field once he gets into professional baseball. The speed really translates, the athleticism translates, and he's just a high IQ type of player where the defensive chops have translated well themselves. So I think that he's sold teams on his ability to stick in the outfield long term. And with all that being said, I think given how this iteration of the draft, so to speak, has progressed, I was happy to snag him at 33.
And then right after this pick, Jeff's on the board at 34 for the Brewers, and he actually takes the final college hitter in this staff draft. Jeff, you wound up with one of the more famous players in college baseball here. What were your thoughts on Tommy White?
Yeah, honestly, at this point in the draft, this is kind of the perfect spot for White. I've said that dating back to, pretty early on in the process. That if, it's late first round or, supplemental first round, I'm all over it. And I think the Brewers would be a great fit too. He's shown a little bit more ability at third base than I think a lot of people had anticipated. I think there's a legit shot that he sticks there for a little bit. And he's had three 20 home run seasons in a Power Five conference. There's not many players, I don't think historically, that can say that. He's always hit. I know that the production has ticked down a little bit each of the 3 years in college, but still, a guy with a 1,000 plus ops, et cetera, and just continues to pummel baseballs. Is there a little bit of chase? Sure. It's not so outrageous that I don't think he's ever going to walk at the pro level. And he hits for average and he hits the ball hard, elevates, his best contact, puts the ball in the air more often than he doesn't. So, yeah, I think, here at 34, I think it's a perfect pick and kind of, prototypical kind of like Brewers power guy here. Mm-hmm. Not all that different from what they got last year with Brock Wilkin, just a little bit more hit, a little bit less power.
Yep. All right. After that, JJ makes his final pick of the draft and starts a little run on pitchers here in the supplemental first. He takes Drew Beam, the right-handed pitcher from Tennessee at 35 for the D-backs. One of the more proven college starters in the country, really strong pitch ability and command, maybe a little bit less swing and miss stuff of some of the other pitchers in this draft. I go with a personal cheese ball who has been an up arrow player in left-handed pitcher Dasan Hill at number 36 for the Guardians. I saw him last summer at the Area Code Games. He's this really lean, wiry, beanpole-looking left-handed pitcher who spun the ball well. I liked the athlete on the mound, and he has added more velocity. He was throwing upper 80s, touching 92, 93. Now he's been sitting in the low 90s, touching a 5, and still has a lot more physical projection coming. Scouts have really praised the feel for strikes that he's shown with his fastball and his breaking ball. So this is kind of a projection upside left-handed pitcher prep pick for me. Ben sticks with the high school pitching demographic at 37 for the Pirates and takes Tegan Coons, who's been a pretty high-profile high school player in this class for a long time. Really good arm speed. He gets in the mid-90s. He also has some more projection. So some similarities maybe between these two picks for me and Ben. And that leaves Peter with his final pick at 38 for the Rockies. Peter, you took Duke lefty Jonathan Santucci. And 2.5 months ago, there was no shot he lasted this far.
2 months ago, I think leading into the Wake series, which literally was the day I think I put a curse on this poor kid. But I think I said I'd take him in the top half of the first round. That doesn't stand today. The command and it has backed up a little bit. Even since last year, the strike throwing is down, throwing strikes at just a 61% overall clip. The fastball command and control is what has me most worried. He's throwing strikes at less than 60% of the time with his heater. He's not really dominating with his fastball. But the stuff is there. Like, it's an aesthetically pleasing operation. I think it's 93, 95 up to 6 and 7 from the left side with carry at the top of the zone. Sharpish gyro type of slide. Like, I think he actually has decent, more of a better feel for his secondary stuff, particularly his slider, than he does his fastball. He'll vary the shape well. It's kind of more of a gyro-y type of pitch against right-handed hitters with a little sharp vertical bite to it. And then it's longer and sweepier against left-handed hitters with that same type of sharpness. I think the miss rate on it this year is 55%. And I think it's a plus pitch. And then he's doesn't throw, he still hasn't really thrown it at all a lot in his college career, but I've also been impressed with his ability when he does throw it to turn over a changeup. It flashes serious late tumbling life. He'll get right-handed hitters to swing over it when he does use it, but I just don't think that the feel for it is there. And again, he just hasn't really thrown it, but he's got it in his back pocket. So I'm really curious to see what he looks like once he gets into professional baseball, because I think that the upside is there. And if you're picking in this, I don't know, supplemental round range where you can get him with your second pick in the draft, I think you can feel probably pretty excited with the upside that he has, but there is a lot of work to be done with him.
Yeah, he's fascinating for a number of reasons, but certainly hasn't lived up to kind of the hopes and expectations that he flashed early this year and our long time excitement for him going back to last fall. But Jeff, you close us out at pick number 39 for the Royals with another off the board selection who maybe is not going to be as much of an off the board selection on our next update. But you go with Illinois high school shortstop Tyler Bell. Tell us about him and that pick and your rationale.
Yeah, I just think he fits into this prototype we see at the back end of the draft. And I don't think he's probably all that dissimilar from other projection prep shortstops that we've seen in recent years. Guys like maybe Anthony Volpe is kind of like the shining star example in recent years of someone that, you know, was taken around this area of the draft, was a principal high school player where, you know, there were baseball skills. When it comes to Bell, there was definitely defensive ability. He's a standout defender. I think every scout you talk to, any cross checker in the area is going to tell you that, yeah, this guy can pick it. There's no doubt it's a plus glove and he's going to remain at shortstop. Switch hitter, the right-handed swing is way ahead of the left-handed swing just in terms of like timing and mechanics and all that sort of thing. He pulls off a lot in the left-handed side and you can see him sort of top off a lot of balls. So, you know, I think as a switch hitter moving forward, it's kind of always a knock for me. I'd rather that guys just mastered one side. I'm like, if you can hit left-handed pitching as a righty, just be a righty, especially if it's a good swing. Like, stop messing around with the matchups. So see how that progresses. I think there's some questions about him as an offensive player. There's not a lot of questions about him just as a shortstop. I think that's helping push him up to the back end of the first round. And with a couple of teams and analysts that I've spoken with, I know that there's been some heat from the teams picking at the back half of the first and in the supplemental first round of, you know, getting some looks in this guy, doing their due diligence, because he is going to be an option there. So, yeah, I think it was a little off the board. Some of it was I didn't like any of the options that still remained. And I started asking around some of my contacts and said, hey, who could go here? That's kind of an interesting pick. And Tyler Bell came up and I went, let's go with it.
Yeah, too. And it's the last pick. You got to kind of take the guy you'd like here. You don't get another chance to call your shot on a player. So I love it. I guess final comments here. We're not going to take too much longer. It's already been close to an hour for this podcast. But I guess picks that are not your own that you guys liked in this draft, and then players that you're maybe surprised did not get taken top 39. If anyone wants to go first, by all means, jump in. Just to give you guys some more time to think, I will give you a couple of mine. I mentioned previously, I like the Ryan Waldschmidt pick a lot from Jeff. The more I hear him talk about Waldschmidt, the more I look into the player. Just a really well-rounded offensive profile that's pretty exciting and stands out in this class. I like Ben's value with Cam Nitti at number 32. I think he's got a chance to go a lot higher than that. And I also really like the, I guess, Jeff, I'm just putting love on yours, but this is also to Peter as well, but Hagan Smith. Like, I like the fact that you guys are both really high on him, just because it makes me feel better about being really high on Hagan Smith. Although I think Hagan Smith went in a range that everyone thinks probably makes sense. And then most surprising player who didn't get selected for me, maybe Carter Johnson. That feels like a player that Ben would have had a lot of interest in the supplemental range. He went with other high school demographics. But Peter, let's go to you.
Yeah, one, I love Ben getting Bazzana at 1-2. Maybe my favorite pick in the draft. No, but in all seriousness, I love the Yannick pick at 16. Jeff with Tibbs at 14. Again, that was a guy that, as we talked through the draft and talked through each of our respective picks, I don't think if I had went with him as high as 8, that would have looked like that crazy of a reach, maybe come July. So I like those a lot. Waldschmidt, I like. And then a guy, Dazon Hill, is another one that I really like. And then someone that was left off, maybe it's a hot-ish take. I wasn't totally surprised with any of the guys being left off. And I think that as it was illustrated in how our draft went and how we've spoken about it on the podcast, it speaks to the openness of the class really after, I don't know, 11, 12 or 13 ish, somewhere in that range where it just could kind of go haywire on draft night. You could see a ton of different names picked in a ton of different spots. So no one that was left off is really that stunning to me.
All right. And Jeff, how about you?
Yeah. I think I liked all the picks that were in the top 10 pretty much. So that's not jumping out and saying anything. I really like the Theo Gillian pick at 21 by Carlos.
I was terrified you were going to take him if I didn't take him there. So
yeah, I honestly, he was definitely in consideration for me at that point. I like the Vance Honeycutt pick to the Rays by Peter. I know that like team isn't a huge consideration or even much of a consideration with these picks, but I kind of think like that's an interesting one, especially in this draft. Kind of guy that they would probably take a shot on, kind of fits their skill set. And I think the player is fascinating. When he was a top 10 pick, you know, I was like, ah, this is kind of 2.0 again. I don't know if he's going to stay there for the full, you know, multi-season draft cycle that we now have where we know where these guys are as freshmen or even before that. But I think now that he's in the mid to back end of the first round, I think that's a really good pick. So I would say those are the two that I probably call out the most in terms of my sort of favorite picks in the draft. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a little surprised, I guess, Malcolm Moore didn't go. I thought he might get sniped somewhere in the last 10 picks or so. Obviously, he hasn't had the season that a lot of people expected. Ryan Johnson's a name that's come up in this area a lot. Though, I mean, I don't know how many people in the staff draft were thrown off by the video of him pacing back and forth before, you know, throwing missiles into the strike zone. And then the other guy that came up when I was kind of asking around with my last pick was Griffin Burkholder, actually, as well.
Yeah, he's fascinating.
So I wondered if maybe he would go in this range, too. So I guess it wasn't like a shock. As much as I think a lot of them were just kind of like, oh, when will that guy go, you know?
Yeah, I don't think this is a great comparison, but just because of where he plays high school baseball and the power, speed, tool set, it wouldn't be shocking if Griffin Burkholder went a lot closer to Johnny Formello's draft selection a year ago.
Sure.
I think they are different players, but I just think about Johnny Formello and how much kind of late helium he got, and there has been a lot of heat on Griffin Burkholder down the stretch. I know some people really like him. So that's a good one to flag as well, Jeff. Okay, cool. I think that about wraps it up for us. If you guys want to get full rationales and the full staff draft, definitely check out the site. It'll be live either as you're listening to this or shortly after. I think the podcast probably drops a little bit earlier than the piece will be on the website. But the same day this podcast comes out, the staff draft will be on the site. You can get full breakdowns from every writer, kind of going through their picks and see everything on the screen. So check that out. For Jeff, for Peter, I'm Carlos. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will see you next time.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.